WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. After a week of escalating violence, the scene in Ferguson, Missouri on Thursday night was one of relative calm as protesters marched with police officers down the streets of the St. Louis suburb. Here's Captain Ronald Johnson of the Missouri Highway Patrol, now Ferguson Police Commander.
And if that was my son or that was my friend, how would I feel and what my emotions would be? And whatever my voice was, I want to have the right to say what that voice is. And that's what we're going to do here today and every day forward.
The tone stood in stark contrast to the days and nights of confrontation between demonstrators, mostly peaceful but angry, and police, often in riot gear, often seen holding military rifles on armored vehicles or firing off tear gas. The cause of the conflict was the shooting death of an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, by a police officer on August 9th. Since then, Ferguson has been headline news, documented minute by minute via tweets, vines, and live streams.
You may no longer be in the area. It is no longer a peaceful protest.
Go shoot! Go shoot!
They are firing rubber bullets and smoke grenades.
Tremaine Lee, national reporter for MSNBC, has been reporting from Ferguson since Monday, August 11th. We spoke to him earlier this week and asked him about the view from what's being called Fergistan.
Wednesday night was the worst night so far. Police officers hurled canisters of tear gas into the crowd. They also launched flash grenades, bang grenades. It was the kind of sight that I understand why people could look at this from around the world and around the country and say it looks like a war zone. And that's how it felt. People running and screaming, their eyes burning, some people vomiting. It's quite a sight, especially in a small city in the Midwest.
And in fact, the Washington Post's Mark Berman wrote that the notion of something playing out on social media is a tiresome platitude at this point. But what's playing out in Ferguson, he said, seems different in that it evokes situations that have happened in other parts of the world. And actually, what we're seeing online does seem to smack of the live reporting during the Arab Spring, right? Citizens posting live streams, people who, by their tweeting on the ground, are becoming familiar names.
This case, and at least my personal experience, has been an experience like no other. Everything is going viral because we haven't seen this level of, I'll call it rebellion, in a long time. Some young people say they've been waiting for a moment like this where they can express themselves, whether they do it peacefully or violently. The death of this young man in this community by a police department that they say has been harassing them for years, they finally now are saying enough is enough. And the consequences, we have burned out stores. We have a militarized police department that have shown up in mass and actually escalated the tension in this community, escalated the violence. But again, it's all playing out before our eyes, all playing out on Twitter and social media, and everyone seems to be participating and watching.
Yeah, I mean, there's an alderman who I never would have had occasion to know about named Antonio French, who seems to be everywhere all the time, uninflectedly reporting the events as they happen. And then you have a reporter like Wesley Lowry of The Washington Post, who's getting arrested, and his last remark is, tweet this.
Wesley Lowry is a colleague. He's a great young journalist. And so we were at one of the press conferences on Monday, and he's firing away on his cell phone, tweeting about it. And the people have a hunger because that's where they're getting their information. But going back to that alderman, he's been here. He's been tweeting and covering the story in a way that the local news media hadn't even been covering it. And so as he's getting hauled away to jail, they're tweeting about it. As Wesley is getting hauled away to jail, and his last words saying, you know, tweet about it, tweet it out. It's a different world, as we all know, and especially folks in the media or have been following the media. Years ago, there was the Gen 6 case in Gen, Louisiana, where a group of young black teenagers, high school students, were charged with attempted murder for beating up one of their young white peers. People from around the country amassed, one of the first times that this young generation mobilized, but we still weren't using Twitter or Facebook that much. Then you jump years later to 2012, to the Trayvon Martin case, when it was all over social media and it expanded and grew. People were using online petitions. People were tweeting and Facebooking. But the images emerging from here in Ferguson, Missouri, are unlike anything we've ever seen, because people in the Trayvon Martin case were gathering by the thousands in an open field, pretty much contained. But here, as the police seem to be beating back a force of mostly peaceful protesters, and their tear gas canisters are flying in, and you're seeing these images in real time. I was on one side street, and I watched as a man was going to open his front door with his keys. So as he's walking across the front lawn, there was a police officer with his rifle trained on him, following him to his front door. All these images are now being blasted across the country.
It's interesting how social media is speaking back to mainstream media. The day after the shooting, NBC News tweeted a picture of Michael Brown, expressionless, wearing a basketball jersey, making what some commentators called a gang sign. And then came the hashtag, if they gunned me down. People of color have been tweeting pairs of photos of themselves with the question, which photo would they use? They have a picture of themselves in a hoodie and then say in their Marine dress uniform. Are the mainstream media getting the message that they need to be more judicious in what photos they choose?
I think how we're choosing our photos and images we're putting out there is still a direct reflection of the diversity in the newsroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've been a journalist for 10 years, and almost every newsroom I've been in, you look around and I'm the only person of color. And that doesn't necessarily give me some sort of wisdom into...
Tremaine, it kind of does.
I guess it does. I mean, that's what diversity is about, right? But I think when we look around and we see these newsrooms that are still so homogenous, and so when they see this young man, hey, it looks fine to me. This is how they look. It's almost like when we talk about violence is normalized in the media and normalized by law enforcement, it's supposed to happen in these places. And so we view everything from that context. And I think in the media sometimes, in these commodity newsrooms, look at it and say, I don't see the problem. This is what they look like. Look what part of town he came from.
Mm-hmm. In a piece for Medium, Cord Jefferson wrote about his frustration and exhaustion with covering what he called the racism beat. I used to think that maybe I'd let my anger serve as an engine, he wrote. But I've since discovered that my anger over each new racist incident is now rivaled and augmented by the anger I feel when I am asked to explain once more why Black people shouldn't be brutalized, insulted, and killed. He's pretty much walked away from this. And I wonder, you've been on this beat. You were one of the first on the Trayvon Martin so-called Stand Your Ground shooting in Florida. Is it getting to you?
Does it weigh on you? Certainly. But is there some responsibility to do so as a journalist and also as a Black journalist? Most definitely. Wednesday night, I get back to the hotel after choking on tear gas and witnessing people scurrying for what some of them believe is their lives. And I come into the bar, they're drinking, everything seems so good, but it's not good. And you look around and everyone in that room is white. And you know, this whole community here has been suffering for a long time. And you know, this is replicated. It's Ferguson here. It's Sanford, Florida, where Trayvon Martin was killed. It's East New York and Brooklyn. It's Chicago. We live in these kind of completely different worlds. And so as a Black journalist who is tasked with trying to go out and tell the stories about, again, how we live and how we die and how Americans suffer and how we overcome and how our institutions have failed us, it does weigh on you. But if not me, who else? You know, if not Wesley Lowery, who else? If not Yemishel Sindor or all the Black journalists who came before us, who had to do their jobs under even harsher conditions, I'm not sure who would. But again, we're here as journalists. This is what we're paid to do. Some of it sometimes is mission-driven because you can see a truth that some others can't see. And as I'm sitting out here talking, then some of these people will trust me because they'll see a brother in me and I can see the same in them and we can talk openly and honestly and I can get the truth. That's important. So I don't take it for granted.
We had you on the show in March of 2012 to talk about Trayvon Martin. And I asked you what you wanted out of that coverage. And here's a clip of your answer.
I would like to see this the beginning of a conversation. I'm certainly interested in seeing where this goes. I wonder if this ultimately is this watershed moment that we all believe it will be and how we'll all be changed. I think we're all going to be a little different after this.
So are we at least a little different?
I think we are a little different. Since the killing of Trayvon Martin, you've had the killing of Jordan Davis in Jacksonville, Florida, by someone who began an altercation with this young man over his loud music and fired into his car. You've had the Radisha McBride case in Detroit, where a young woman showed up at someone's doorstep and they fired a shotgun through a screen door and tore off half of her face. Jonathan Ferrell in Charlotte, North Carolina, he gets in a car accident. He shows up at someone's door looking for help. She called the police. They end up gunning this young man down, again, unarmed. Eric Garner, more recently in New York City, selling loose cigarettes, died in a police chokehold. In each one of these cases, there was a mass of media around it. These stories went viral. We can go case by case and city by city, and people know their names. In the past, I don't think we would have cared enough. I don't think we would have had the capital to do this. On top of President Obama in his watershed moment in the Trayvon Martin case, where he finally opened up and talked about race, how we value or don't value black men's lives in America. That all matters. And I think the Trayvon Martin case did that. The saddest part is news organizations hop on top of this, peel away the layer and analyze it from every single angle. But I'm not sure where it makes a difference. With stop and frisk, that's kind of in its last vestiges. But now we have the broken window policing, where we're seeing the same results. Black and brown men ground out into powder and pushed into the system. Standing ground laws. People dug in harder in Florida to maintain those laws that seem to allow people to form their vendetta mentality. But we are different. The world is more receptive to these ideas of how our system created this framework around particularly black and brown men. There are lethal consequences, and we're all kind of indicted in it because we all play a role because we've all normalized it. We recognize it, but now what? Hopefully in a couple of years, the conversation we'll be having will be much different. You know, I wouldn't put any money on it, but let's hope.
Tremaine, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, Glenn.
Tremaine Lee is national reporter for MSNBC, now in Ferguson, Missouri.
Coming up, for ISIS, death, brutal and inevitable, is a big part of its messaging strategy.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Monday, the World Health Organization announced that the death toll of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa topped 1,000, making it the deadliest Ebola epidemic on record. Since March, cases have also been documented in Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and now Nigeria. This has led to breathless coverage of a terrifying Ebola march around the world, leaving grotesquely ravaged corpses along its path and heading to our shores.
The CDC is raising its alert to the highest level as it monitors the spreading virus, keeping a close watch for cases here in the U.S.
And of course, it can travel by air right along with an infected passenger.
But I think it's dangerous to say things like, let's calm the rhetoric down because we don't know.
Dr. Daniel Bausch is an associate professor at the Tulane School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine and has recently returned from Guinea, where he treated patients in association with the World Health Organization. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The headlines are terrifying, a plane ride away and all that, but also gravely misleading. What is so difficult in distinguishing lethality from communicability?
Well, that's precisely the point that many people miss. Ebola, of course, is a very lethal virus, and so your chances of dying if you get it are terrifyingly high, but your chances of getting it are actually much lower than many other viruses that we're much more familiar with. You have to have direct contact with the blood and bodily fluids, and it's only during the period of illness, so it's not when someone is incubating the virus. So if you, for example, traveled with someone and they were healthy right next to you in the plane, and then 3 or 4 days later you learned that that person came down with Ebola virus, you would still have zero risk of contracting it.
One of your frustrations is that even in the face of extremely nuanced coverage by the journalists, a single headline by a careless or cynical headline writer can undo all of the care that was put into the reporting itself.
When I see headlines that say Ebola virus likely to go global, even if in the text of the story that they really have it right, most people will think that that means that they, somewhere in a small town in the United States or in Europe, they have a risk of getting Ebola, and the risks for those people are just infinitesimally small. So say that sometimes the scientific community has been a little bit mixed on this and how we portray it, but we need to keep the focus on the people who are really at risk, and those are people with direct contact with blood and bodily fluids. They're healthcare workers, they're family members taking care of a sick person, there are people attending a funeral and touching a corpse. If you don't do any of those things, even if you live in Sierra Leone and Liberia, your risk of getting Ebola is extremely small.
There's something so exotic
about Ebola, and it has filled a place in the popular imagination now for some years, partly due to, well, to movies like Outbreak in 1995.
We got 19 dead. We got 100 more infected. It's spreading like a brush fire.
What are you talking about?
If one of them's got it, then 10 of them have got it now. And if one of them gets out of Cedar Creek, we have a very interesting problem.
If that bug gets out of there, 260 million Americans will be dead or dying.
It seems that the morbid fascination with it extends even to its treatment. When an experimental drug was employed, it had somehow become a miracle serum. Does anyone in the medical community call this cocktail of antibodies a miracle serum?
No, no one would call it a miracle serum. And the other term that I've seen, secret serum or mystery serum, this is an experimental drug. There's published literature on this. It's not something that was kept secret. And one has to remember that, especially the media, the situation in West Africa is extremely tense. There's circulated amongst the already very suspicious population the idea that we have nefarious intentions trying to manipulate populations, that we are harvesting people's organs. So a headline that says that there's a secret serum, certainly not helping, and in the worst case, has the risk to lead to violence.
Is there a danger to the Western public to be exposed not to the Ebola virus, but to the overblown coverage about it?
For you to be concerned about it because you're a concerned citizen and we need to react to a very significant problem in West Africa, I definitely encourage that. But for people losing sleep or having a fear for their own safety, their own health, that's really misguided. And it also tends to take a lot of time and energy and potentially financial and human resources away from where they really need to be put in West Africa, where we should be focusing.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Daniel Bausch is an associate professor at the Tulane School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine and head of the Virology and Emerging Infections Department at the U.S. Naval Medical Research Unit No. 6 in Lima, Peru. He spoke to us from there.
This week, Vice News released a documentary called The Islamic State, promising exclusive access into the extremist group formerly known as ISIS.
A few weeks later, IS launched a large-scale offensive against the 17th Division. They overran the base, killing at least 50 regime soldiers. Their corpses were displayed in downtown Raqqa, their heads mounted on fence posts. It sent a clear message that the city is firmly under IS control.
It's the closest a Western news outlet has gotten to ISIS, but it comes at a cost, made obvious in the film by the dominating presence of an Islamic State press officer and the prevailing view of the militants as guardians of order and defenders of the faith. Since it seized control of parts of Iraq and Syria, much of what we've seen of Islamic State comes filtered through a well-oiled media machine, which churns out its own images while keeping a death grip on the reporters who enter its territory and the journalism that emerges from it. News agencies like Reuters and the Associated Press have been relying on local photographers who work anonymously as stringers in the land claimed by the Islamic State. Sebastian Meyer, an American photojournalist based in Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan, says these photographers tend to fall into two groups.
There are the photographers who are allowed to work by the Islamic State, and those who take enormous risks to take photographs on smartphones. There's also a third side, although mainly distributed by AFP, and those are images that the Islamic State posts to their own websites, social media. AFP has a team who look at those sites, and then after verifying that the images are true as best they can, they redistribute those photographs.
You spoke to a photographer in Mosul. The name you give him, not his real name, is Abu Mirwan. Can you describe what his experience was?
He was a photographer for about 15 years, and when Islamic State came in, they made photography illegal. A group of Islamic State officials met with him, and it sounded like a very convivial meeting. They seemed to say, it's fine, we don't have a problem with it. But before he started working, he was then put in touch with another person who said to him, you will do exactly what we tell you, and if we find that you do anything that we don't like, we'll kill you. He went to the Mosul television station, and he met with a third person, and that guy told him, you will give me all of your memory cards from your digital cameras, and the images that I like, you can distribute. I will take a copy that will go in our archive, and the images I don't like, we'll delete. And if I find that you don't give me all of your memory cards, if I find that you are sneaking memory cards, I'll give you 100 lashes.
So, how does this play out in terms of the photographs he takes?
He has a minder. The minder sometimes works a bit, you know, like a Hollywood director, and will get crowds to swarm around him and chant pro-Islamic State slogans. And the other aspect is he has to do what he's told. The night that the Islamic State attacked the city of Sinjar, a city of about 300,000+ people, he got a call to say, you have to come and cover our assault. So he went with them and he covered the assault. And then as the Yazidi fled up the mountain, he saw three children die in front of him. And too embarrassed to cry in front of the family members, especially the men, he turned away. At that point, he was summoned by militants of the Islamic State who said, come here. And they took him to a group of 30 men lined up on the ground, face down with their hands tied behind their back. They said, photograph this. They then executed all 30 men in front of three or four of their female family members. He has no other choice but to do what they say, so he photographed it. They want to show that they are a tough and terrifying fighting force, and then they also want to show that life under their rule is lovely and pleasant, and every good human would want to convert to Islam to then join the caliphate. That's what they want to show.
These ISIS-approved photos obviously raise a host of ethical issues, as you do in your article. Who is taking the photos? What's their relationship with their subject? How the images are framed to the public when printed in Western media outlets, and they are everywhere. What are your thoughts on their use? Should we be glad to have any record at all from within the Islamic State?
This is a very, very serious question. The Islamic State uses its propaganda wing as a military tool. Just through fear alone, they can move huge populations of people. I've been covering the Yazidi, who've made headlines recently about, I guess you'd call it a pogrom that's happening right now against them.
A group that was trapped on Mount Sinjar on the Syrian border by the Islamic State.
Yes, exactly. And the majority of the Yazidi didn't actually physically witness anything, but the fear of the Islamic State is what made them flee into the situation they're currently in. And the printing of ISIS propaganda, every newspaper that carries a terrifying photograph of the Islamic State is helping their military success.
The implication of your argument is that Reuters and the Associated Press and AFP and countless other news sites should just walk away from this in order to sap part of Islamic State's strength on the ground, which is a good argument strategically, but I wonder if it is good with regard to journalism.
I think it's unjournalistic and unethical for journalists to turn a blind eye and to not print things, but to jump straight into printing any little piece of propaganda from the Islamic State because we're just so thirsty for visual images is equally unethical.
How do you distinguish between a photo of brutality that you should distribute and one that you shouldn't?
I'll give you an example. Human Rights Watch did a lot of work on the images of the Tikrit massacre. They were the first really shocking images to come out from the Islamic State. It showed huge numbers of men lined up on the ground and militants of the Islamic State shooting them in the back. Human Rights Watch did an excellent job using those photographs and satellite imagery to track down where they thought the massacres happened, to find out if they were true or not. And a lot of newspapers reported on their report. using those images of quite grotesque brutality in the context of a human rights investigation, I think that's absolutely appropriate. But if you look at the cover of the New York Daily News from the day that those images came out, they splash the image of a guy being shot in the back of the head, blood pouring out of his face. That is pure shock and horror. I think that is a great example of how not to do it.
So what is it principally, do you think, we're all missing about what's going on there?
The truth. There are a huge number of rumors about what's going on there, and it's impossible or almost impossible to verify any of it. There's a rumor that has actually been reported by a number of different newspapers and magazines of 500 Yazidi women who have been sold into sexual slavery. And it works to the Islamic State's advantage that we don't know, and that we are afraid, and that we do think it's true, or we do think it's possible.
Sebastian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sebastian Meyer is a photojournalist in Iraq. He joined us from Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan.
Coming up, a marine biologist who grew up on Shark Week is now among the cable tradition's biggest critics.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For most of law enforcement history, what happened in the interrogation room stayed in the interrogation room. Only signed statements emerged. But police misconduct, jury suspicion, and inexpensive technology have converged to make video recordings of interrogations common practice. Many states mandate video records, and prosecutors have found them to be both a check on police abuse and a powerful tool to impress jurors. Till now, the U.S. Justice Department has resisted, but a new policy now requires the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and several other federal law enforcement agencies to videotape interrogations of criminal suspects, a large step in making the practice standard nationwide. Jennifer Mnookin, a law professor at UCLA, says the argument for videotaped interrogations resonates with all sides of the legal process.
If we videotape interrogations, then the prosecutors can see what the suspect acknowledged. So can the jury. So can the defense attorney. The suspect has to live with his or her words. It provides much better information to everybody.
And if they are being coerced to make the confession, theoretically at least, that coercion will be evident on the tape, right?
That's right. There's two benefits. One is it will probably reduce that coercion precisely because it's being taped. And if it does occur, well, everybody can see that too.
Before we get to your concerns, though, I want to ask you about why the Justice Department has dragged its feet till now amid all sorts of criticism and controversy over decades.
Many law enforcement officials, especially those who haven't had experience with the practice, are concerned that the interrogation techniques that they regularly use might come across as looking kind of unsavory or unfair or unreasonable. I think they're also sometimes concerned that potential defendants and suspects will learn more about those interrogation techniques and perhaps become better at resisting them.
I must say, my experience is that when a government agency is concerned that one of its practices might be deemed by the public to be unfair or unreasonable, it's because the practice is unfair or unreasonable. Is the Justice Department hiding these tactics because they're suspect to begin with?
Well, I think there is some degree of controversy over the line between reasonable persuasion and coercion. So, for example, is it reasonable for the interrogator to intimate that they have evidence in the case that they don't actually have? On the one hand, if it gets somebody talking and telling the truth, it may be quite valuable. On the other hand, if it leads a suspect to think, wow, they have DNA. The DNA is going to show that it isn't me, and I can get out of this situation by giving this interrogator what they want. It can lead to a false confession. So it is true that videotaping more of these interrogations may lead some courts to reconsider the limits of what counts as voluntary.
One way of looking at this is that it is a categorical victory for truth in prosecution. But you have caveats.
I do. First, it's important to say that on balance, I do think that taping interrogations in their entirety is a good policy. It's also an interesting reform because it does have such substantial support from all sides of the adversarial process. And that's quite unusual. Defense attorney organizations support it, and so do many prosecutors and many parts of law enforcement. But I guess I have two significant concerns. One is to make sure that these interrogations are recorded in their entirety, that the police can't turn the video recorder on and off. If they are able to turn them on and off, we don't know what happens off camera, and that's a very significant concern. Most of the policies on this, including the new federal policy, do require that when videotaping occurs, it occurs in its entirety. So let's just hope that they do adhere to that. The other concern is about the details of how we tape, what the camera shows, who we include in the frame. A researcher named Dan Lassiter at Ohio University and others have done a pretty remarkable series of studies. He finds that if you take the videotape only of the suspect, viewers are much more likely to think that the confession was voluntary and not coercive, as compared to if you take the video from a perspective that shows both the interrogator and the suspect in the same frame.
Aha, pull back to reveal.
Exactly. If you see the interrogator in the frame as well, suddenly the interrogation process looks different. The federal policy does not mandate or even suggest anything in particular about camera perspective.
Juries, because they watch so much television about the TV version of criminal justice, expect to see video. Is this policy in the name of more transparency, or is it in the name of giving jurors what they think they deserve?
I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest. I am not at all convinced that in the ordinary course of things, juries, or for that matter, anybody, is necessarily going to be all that good at telling apart true confessions and false confessions just by watching them. We do know certain red flags that may be associated with false confessions. In many of the known false confession cases, the interrogations were unusually long. But at the same time, lots of true confessions may come after long interrogations. We may also sometimes see the interrogator feeding information to the suspect. But again, that kind of feeding probably takes place in lots of true confessions too. And so we get these confessions on camera, but that doesn't necessarily mean that by watching them, we will be able to diagnose them as false. And if I'm right, then videotaped interrogations may pose a particular danger precisely because of their power. I think we're likely still to see some false confessions, and we're likely still to see some judges and juries persuaded by these false confessions and believing in their truth.
Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Mnookin is a law professor at UCLA.
A landmark moment for cameras and criminal justice occurred in 1991, the trial of a young woman named Pamela Smart for the murder of her husband, Gregory Smart. The case oozed with tabloid succulence. She was 22, pretty, a media coordinator for several New Hampshire high schools, charged with conspiracy to commit murder with her lover and eventual trigger man, the sweet-faced 15-year-old Billy Flynn. The media seized upon the juicy optics and took it to the court of public opinion.
According to police, Pamela Smart convinced her teenage lover to murder her husband.
Now, Pamela Smart offering to pay each teenager $1,000 for the murder of her husband.
The Pamela Smart trial was the first to be covered on TV, gavel to gavel. But the trial inspired much more imagery and ink. Among them, the TV movie with Helen Hunt playing Smart, the novel by Joyce Maynard, and the feature film inspired by the novel starring Nicole Kidman, directed by Gus Van Sant.
You're not anybody in America unless you're on TV. On TV is where we learn about who we really are. Because what's the point of doing anything worthwhile if nobody's watching? And if people are watching, it makes you a better person.
A new documentary focusing on the coverage of the case, called Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart, premieres on HBO on Monday. Director Jeremiah Zager says he wanted the film to look at the lookers, that is, the coverage and the news consumers, including the lawyers, the judge, and the jury. He says Pamela Smart's case began just as the litigation-obsessed media machine we know today was ramping up.
It was the beginning of CNN. It was the beginning of Court TV. It was the beginning of all these cable news networks who needed to fill a 24-hour news cycle. WMUR, the local TV station, decided to cancel all the shows that were broadcast during the trial and broadcast only the trial. People were hungry for whatever they could hear about the Pamela Smart case.
So a local TV station became the Pamela Smart channel, and like the OJ trial that happened later, it created its own media stars. So tell me about WMUR reporter Bill Spencer. He actually plays himself in the Helen Hunt film.
Bill Spencer is a larger-than-life character. He considers himself a muckraker of sorts, and he's the guy that broke the story ultimately. He's the guy that got the first interview with Pam, and then he ran with it. And he was also being pushed really hard to keep going after this story.
Going after the story or going after her? I mean, was he part of the crowd that convicted her in advance of the verdict?
He was. And he felt like he had uncovered the facts of the case before the police. And as a result, he broadcast 2 days before the jurors were even picked a documentary that over and over again stated how guilty Pamela Smart was.
So let's talk about the venue for this trial and whether or not it was possible for Pamela Smart to get a fair trial.
I think in this case, the media became a poison, and it poisoned every witness, and it poisoned every moment of that trial.
And part of your evidence for that comes from something extraordinary. The actual tapes that a juror made every night in her bathtub after each day's trial about what she herself was thinking. First of all, this juror said that they didn't give Pamela Smart a defense.
I felt like when they said that defense rests its case, I couldn't believe it. I was like, no way. That's not fair, because I don't believe she deserves that. And I think that the circus of the media was ridiculous. About 10 billion cameras going off, and everybody's taking billions of pictures, and which I think rots. I just think it rots.
I think in that tape, there's a lot of regret that you can hear in her voice. Regret over the sentence Pamela Smart has received and regret over having delivered that guilty verdict. And I think what you're hearing there is her recounting what led up to that sentence and her justifying giving it to her. You know, she didn't get a defense. It's not my fault.
She said that she wouldn't have convicted Pamela Smart if she'd known that the sentence was going to be life in prison without parole.
I really believe that I would have hung that jury, because I was damn close to doing it anyway, had I known what this sentence was going to be. I'm not responsible for what I was to consider as evidence. I had no control over evidence that was given. I believe there's so much that no one knows, and we'll probably never know.
But she also said that there was plenty of reasonable doubt. So why did she convict?
The truth is that 12 Angry Men scenario, where Henry Fonda sits at the end of the table and convinces the 11 other jurors that there's reasonable doubt, is a fantasy. In reality, when three jurors or less feel there's reasonable doubt, they're swayed 90% of the time to the majority's opinion, like a schoolyard. Like peer pressure. When there's four, it decreases to about 50%. And ultimately, I think she was swayed. She looked at the evidence with those jurors and, you know, they wanted to go home.
So what do you believe at the end of this process? That it would be better if there were no cameras in the courtroom?
Well, no, not necessarily, because I think when you look at, you know, the lack of transparency in military trials, it's troubling. And there is a need for transparency in the trial process. And the problem is when the trial becomes sensationalized, commerce and justice begin to mix. And I think that's really problematic.
So what's the solution?
I don't have solutions. I don't have clear answers. And I think the film is attempting to bring up questions so that ideally, you know, people involved in the justice system can make structures to make things more fair. Now, one of the attorneys we talked to, J. Albert Johnson, said the trial should have been stayed. And it should have been stayed and stayed and stayed and stayed until it was no longer a story.
Wait until the controversy blew over? That could take decades if you have people like Bill Spencer on the case.
Right. And that's the problem. And there's a desire for retribution in the public. And therefore, it's very possible that a person who didn't commit the crime they're convicted of is convicted of that crime. Until there's not a thirst for blood, it's very difficult in a sensationalized environment to find where the truth lies.
Where do you think the trial went most wrong for Pamela Smart?
It went wrong every step of the way. The young men who took plea bargain deals, who actually committed this murder, were housed together and therefore able to get their stories straight. The young woman who was the key witness was under contract for $100,000 for a movie deal. The media was sensationalizing every moment and every soundbite and every image that was recorded. The judge also got caught up in it. At the end of the trial, he said he hoped that Clint Eastwood would play him in the movie. And that was sort of a joke, but it was emblematic of an environment that had been created. For that reason, she got a very unfair trial.
Do you think she did it?
I think the only people who know what happened is Pamela Smart and Bill Flynn. He says she told him to kill her husband. She says she never told him that. It's impossible to prove it either way. What is clear is that this woman got an incredibly unfair trial. And what is clear is that her sentence is incredibly disproportionate, that she'll spend the rest of her life in prison without the possibility of parole, which, by the way, Charles Manson has the possibility of parole. And these young men are about to get out. You know, they're on work release as we speak. And what is clear also is that there is a problem when we cease to question the systems of our government, our justice system, our political system, our media system. If anything, I hope that this film allows the audience to question more and to feel comfortable questioning, that what makes our system strong are the questions that we ask.
And what's the question we should be asking of the media?
How are these images being shot? How are these images being edited? How are these images being condensed? How are these sound bites being condensed? What are they focusing on? What does it mean when they focus on the hairstyle of the defendant? What does it mean when, before they talk about the facts of the case, they talk about her composure? Are we creating a narrative that we would like this person to be? Or are we actually trying to understand who this person is and what they've done?
Jeremiah, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jeremiah Zager is the director of the new documentary Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart, which premieres on HBO on August 18th.
This week is Shark Week on the Discovery Channel, the annual block of shark-centric programming watched by 53 million people last year. Begun in 1988, Shark Week has become a cultural touchstone. Witness the 30 Rock episode where Tracy Morgan's character dispenses some advice to Kenneth the Page.
So here's some advice I wish I would have got when I was your age. Live every week like a Shark Week.
Back in the 80s, David Schiffman was a small boy from Pittsburgh who grew up enraptured by sharks and by Shark Week. Now, though, he is a marine biologist, and though he's still a Shark Week watcher, he is now often appalled by the programming's casual mix of fact and fiction. So Schiffman, who has served as an informal advisor to the series, has taken to tweeting corrections to the fiction and links to shark facts for his 18,000 followers. David, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
At some point, I gather, it began to dawn on you that the info part of the tainment was being overwhelmed by the tainment part?
It's less of a case of it dawning on me and more of a case of an actual shift in programming content. There have always been concerns that Shark Week focuses on stories about sharks biting people, which happens so rarely that multiple Shark Week specials often reference the same incident. Last year was sort of the last straw for me when they aired a special called Megalodon, the Monster Shark Lives, which claimed that Carcharocles megalodon is not, in fact, extinct. They've been extinct for about 2 million years.
Are Drake's calculations correct? Could there be a monster creature in these waters deadlier than any known shark? A shark big enough to take down a whale. Colin Drake was looking for a monster, and he knew it.
The scientists and witnesses in the show were all actors. They had photoshopped images that have since gone viral on social media, and this resulted in a great deal of fear among the viewing public. In an extremely long documentary, it was 2 hours, there was a confusingly worded disclaimer at the end for about 3 seconds. It said, some of the incidents here have been dramatized.
Yeah, and I'm laughing. It's so not funny. And you say it's getting worse.
Shark Week 2014 opened with Shark of Darkness, The Wrath of Submarine, which is about a mythical giant great white shark, falsely claiming that a fishing boat accident in which actual people died was attributable to this mythical giant shark that doesn't exist. Last year, Shark Week aired a special called The Top 10 Deadliest Sharks or something, and of the top 10 deadliest sharks, 5 of them have never killed anyone.
Now, you could just sit there and get aggravated, or you can act, and act you have. Give me an example of what a Schiffman tweet looks like.
My most popular tweet from last year, after there was some confusion with a mermaid documentary aired by Animal Planet and with a giant squid documentary, I don't remember if it was on Discovery or Animal Planet, people thought that giant squids weren't real, but they think that mermaids are. The tweet that got the most traction last year was, let's get this straight, mermaids are not real, Megalodon was real, but it's extinct now, and giant squid and narwhals are real. Science literacy is falling, and that's bad for a lot of reasons. I recently learned that Bigfoot Hunters was renewed for a 6th season, which means that people have watched for 5 seasons a group of folks trying and failing to find Bigfoot.
One of the things that Shark Week does is exacerbate shark hysteria and impute onto wildlife a kind of evil.
There's a great deal of evidence from the social science literature that suggests that how the media presents an environmental issue affects how the public perceives that environmental issue and affects what policymakers do about it. And sharks are in trouble. 24% of sharks, skates, and rays are considered threatened with extinction by the IUCN Red List. That's a lot.
Are people going out and fishing for and killing sharks with impunity because we so fear them?
Not directly because of Shark Week, but because of a misportrayal and misrepresentation and misunderstanding of sharks that is perpetuated in no small part by Shark Week.
I know as a scientist you're frustrated by the excesses, but your entire life overlaps with the history of Shark Week. You are the Shark Week generation, and it's influenced you a great deal. So what's great about Shark Week?
Well, Shark Week does still have some extremely high-quality science and conservation programming, the flagship of which is the Alien Sharks series, which focuses on the deep-sea biodiversity, crazy, weird sharks that people have never heard of but are really amazing. Shark Week gets people interested in sharks. It gets them talking about sharks. But imagine how much better that would be if they were promoting facts instead of pseudoscience and fear-mongering.
David, thank you.
Thank you.
David Schiffman is a marine biologist and a contributor to SouthernFriedScience.com.
So it's entirely possible that if it did exist, Submarine could still be alive today. So what do you say? Do you think Submarine is really out there, or is this shark tale too big and too bad to be believed?
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, and Neera Sharma. We had more help from Andrew Chug, and our show was edited by Brooke. The technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.